I prompted. He nodded. Okay, the killer took Jerry Vincent's cell phone, either off his body or it was in his briefcase. Okay. I got the call records yesterday right before I saw you. On the day he was killed, he got 3 calls from the Bureau. 4 days before that, there were 2. He was talking to somebody over there, or they were talking to him. Who? I can't tell. All outgoing calls from over there register on the main number. All I know is he got calls from the Bureau. No names. How long were the calls? Bosch hesitated, unsure what to divulge. He looked down at the tablet in his hand and I saw him grudgingly decide to share more. He was going to get angry when I had nothing to share back. They were all short calls. How short? None of them over a minute. Then maybe they were just wrong numbers. He shook his head. That's too many wrong numbers. They wanted something from him. Anybody from there check in on the homicide investigation? Not yet. I thought about this and shrugged. Well, maybe they will, and then you'll know. Yeah, and maybe they won't. It's not their style, if you know what I mean. Now your turn. What do you have that's federal? Nothing. I confirmed that Vincent had no federal cases. I watched Bosch do a slow burn as he realized I had played him. You're telling me you have found no federal connections, not even a Bureau business card in that office. That's right, nothing. There's been a rumor going around about a federal grand jury looking into corruption in the state courts. You know anything about that? I shook my head. I've been on the shelf for a year. Thanks for the help. Look, detective, I don't get this. Why can't you just call over there and ask who is calling your victim? Isn't that how an investigation should proceed? Bosch smiled like he was dealing with a child. If they want me to know something, they'll come to me. If I called them, they'll just shine me on. If this was part of a corruption probe, or they've got something else going, the chances of them talking to a local cop are between slim and none. If they're the ones who got him killed, then make it none. How would they get him killed? I told you, they kept calling. They wanted something. They were pressuring him. Maybe someone else knew about it and thought he was a risk. That's a lot of conjecture about 5 calls that don't even add up to 5 minutes. Bosch held up the yellow pad. No more conjecture than this list. What about the laptop? What about it? Is that what this is all about? Something in his computer? You tell me. How can I tell you when I have no idea what was in it? Bosch nodded the point and stood up. Have a good day, counselor. He walked out, carrying the legal pad at his side. I was left wondering whether he had been warning me or playing me the whole time he had been in the room. Lorna and Sisko arrived together 15 minutes after Bosch's departure, and we convened in Vincent's office. I took a seat behind the dead lawyer's desk, and they sat side by side in front of it. It was another scorekeeping session in which we went over cases, what had been accomplished the night before, and what still needed to be done. With Sisko driving, I had visited 11 of Vincent's clients the night before, signing up 8 of them and giving back files to the remaining 3. These were the priority cases, potential clients I hoped to keep because they could pay or their cases had garnered some form of merit in my review. They were cases I could win or be challenged by. So it had not been a bad night. I had even convinced the woman charged with indecent exposure to keep me on as her attorney. And of course, bagging Walter Elliott was the icing on the cake. Lorna reported that she had faxed him a representation contract and it had already been signed and returned. We were in good shape there. I could start chipping away at the $100,000 in the trust account. We next set the plan for the day. I told Lorna that I wanted her and Wren, if she showed up, to run down the remaining clients, apprise them of Jerry Vincent's demise, and set up appointments for me to discuss the options of legal representation. I also wanted Lorna to continue building the calendar and familiarizing herself with Vincent's files and financial records. I told Sisko I wanted him to focus his attention on the Elliott case, with particular emphasis on witness maintenance. This meant that he had to take the preliminary defense witness list, which had already been compiled by Jerry Vincent, and prepare subpoenas for the law enforcement officers and other witnesses who might be considered hostile to the defense's cause. For the paid expert witness and others who were willingly going to testify at trial for the defense, he had to make contact and assure them that the trial was moving forward as scheduled with me replacing Vincent at the helm. Got it, Sisko said. What about the Vincent investigation? You still want me monitoring? Yes, keep tabs on that and let me know what you find out. I found out that they spent last night sweating somebody but kicked him loose this morning. Who? I don't know yet. A suspect. They cut him loose, so whoever it was is cleared, for now. I nodded as I thought about this. No wonder Bosch looked like he had been up all night. What are you going to be doing today? Lorna asked. My priority starting today is Elliot. There are a few things on these other cases that I'll need to pay some attention to, but for the most part, I'm going to be on Elliot from here on out. We've got jury selection in 8 days. Today, I want to start at the crime scene. I should go with you, Sisko said. No, I just want to get a feel for the place. You can get in there with a camera and tape measure later. Mick, isn't there any way you can convince Elliot to delay? Lorna asked. Doesn't he realize that you need time to study and understand the case? I told him that, but he's not interested. He made it a condition of my hire. I had to agree to go to trial next week or he'd find another lawyer who could. He says he's innocent and doesn't want to wait a single day longer to prove it. Do you believe him? I shrugged. Doesn't matter. He believes it. And he's got this strange confidence in it all turning out his way, like the Monday morning box office. So, I either get ready to go to trial at the end of next week, or I lose the client. Just then, the door to the office swung open and revealed Wren Williams standing tentatively in the doorway. Excuse me, she said. Hello, Wren, I said. Glad you're here. Could you wait out there in reception, and Lorna will be right out to work with you? No problem. You also have one of the clients waiting out here, Patrick Henson. He was already waiting when I came in. I looked at my watch. It was 5 of 9. It was a good sign in regard to Patrick Henson. Then send him in. A young man walked in. Patrick Henson was smaller than I thought he would be, but maybe it was the low center of gravity that made him a good surfer. He had the requisite hardened tan, but his hair was cropped short. No earrings, no white shell necklace or shark's tooth. No tattoos that I could see. He wore black cargo pants and what probably passed as his best shirt. It had a collar. Patrick, we spoke on the phone yesterday. I'm Mickey Haller, and this is my case manager, Lorna Taylor. This big guy is Sisko, my investigator. He stepped toward the desk and shook our hands. His grip was firm. I'm glad you decided to come in. Is that your fish on the wall back there? Without moving his feet, Henson swiveled at the hips as if on a surfboard and looked at the fish hanging on the wall.
Yeah, that's Betty.
You gave a stuffed fish a name? Lorna asked. What, was it a pet?
Henson smiled, more to himself than to us.
No, I caught it a long time ago, back in Florida. We hung it by the front door in the place I was sharing in Malibu. My roommates and me, we'd always say, "Hello, Betty," to it when we came home. It was kind of stupid.
He swiveled back and looked at me.
Speaking of names, do we call you Trick?
Nah, that was just a name my agent came up with. I don't have him anymore. You can just call me Patrick.
Okay, and you told me you had a valid driver's license.
Sure do. He reached into a front pocket and removed a thick nylon wallet. He pulled his license out and handed it to me. I studied it for a moment and then handed it to Sisko. He studied it a little longer and then nodded, giving it his official approval.
Okay, Patrick, I need a driver, I said. I provide the car and gas and insurance, and you show up here every morning at 9 to drive me wherever I need to go. I told you the pay schedule yesterday. You still interested?
I'm interested.
Are you a safe driver? Lorna asked.
I've never had an accident, Patrick said.
I nodded my approval. They say an addict is best suited for spotting another addict. I was looking for signs that he was still using. Heavy eyelids, slow speech, avoidance of eye contact. But I didn't pick up on anything.
When can you start?
He shrugged.
I don't have anything. I mean, whenever you want, I guess.
How about we start right now? Today will be a test drive. We'll see how you do and we can talk about it at the end of the day.
Sounds good to me. Okay, well, we're going to get out of here and hit the road, and I'll explain in the car how I like things to work. Cool. He hooked his thumbs in his pockets and awaited the next move or instruction. He looked like he was about 30, but that was because of what the sun had done to his skin. I knew from the file that he was only 24 and still had a lot to learn. Today, the plan was to take him back to school. We took the 10 out of downtown and headed west toward Malibu. I sat in the back and opened my computer on the fold-down table. While I waited for it to boot up, I told Patrick Henson how it all worked. Patrick, I haven't had an office since I left the public defender's office 12 years ago. My car is my office. I've got two other Lincolns just like this one. I keep them in rotation. Each one's got a printer, a fax, and I've got a wireless card in my computer. Anything I have to do in an office, I can do back here while I'm on the road to the next place. There are more than 40 courthouses spread across LA County. Being mobile is the best way to do business. Cool, Patrick said. I wouldn't want to be in an office either. Damn right, I said. Too claustrophobic. My computer was ready. I went to the file where I kept generic forms and motions and began to customize a pre-trial motion to examine evidence. I'm working on your case right now, Patrick. He looked at me in the mirror. What do you mean? Well, I reviewed your file, and there's something Mr. Vincent hadn't done that I think we need to do that may help. What's that? Get an independent appraisal of the necklace you took. They list the value as $25,000, and that bumps you up to a felony theft category. But it doesn't look like anybody ever challenged that. You mean, like, if the diamonds are bogus, there's no felony? It could work out like that, but I was thinking of something else, too. What? I pulled his file out of my bag so I could check a name. Let me ask you a few questions first, Patrick, I said. What were you doing in that house where you took the necklace? He shrugged his shoulders. I was dating the old lady's youngest daughter. I met her on the beach and was sort of teaching her to surf. We went out a few times and hung out. One time there was a birthday party at the house, and I was invited, and the mother was given the necklace as a gift. That's when you learned its value. Yeah, the father said they were diamonds when he gave it to her. He was real proud of them. So then, the next time you were at the house, you stole the necklace. He didn't respond. It wasn't a question, Patrick. It's a fact. I'm your lawyer now, and we need to discuss the facts of the case. Just don't ever lie to me, or I won't be your lawyer anymore. Okay. So, the next time you were in the house, you stole the necklace. Yeah. Tell me about it. We were there alone, using the pool, and I said I had to go to the can, only I really just wanted to check the medicine cabinet for pills. I was hurting. There weren't any in the bathroom downstairs, so I went upstairs and looked around. I looked in the old lady's jewelry box and saw the necklace. I just took it. He shook his head, and I knew why. He was thoroughly embarrassed and defeated by the actions his addiction had made him take. I'd been there myself, and knew that looking back from sobriety was almost as scary as looking forward. It's all right, Patrick. Thank you for being honest. What did the guy say when you pawned it? He said he'd only give me 4 bills because the chain was gold, but he didn't think the diamonds were legit. I told him he was full of shit, but what could I do? I took the money and went down to TJ. I needed the tabs, and so I took what he was giving. I was so messed up on the stuff, I didn't care. What's the name of the girl? It's not in the file. Mandolin? Like the instrument? Her parents call her Mandy. Have you talked to her since you were arrested? No, man, we're done. Now the eyes in the mirror looked sad and humiliated. Stupid, Henson said. The whole thing was stupid. I thought about things for a moment, and then reached into my jacket pocket and pulled out a Polaroid photograph. I handed it over the seat and tapped Patrick on the shoulder with it. Take a look at that. He took the photo and held it on top of the steering wheel while he looked at it. What the hell happened to you? He asked. I tripped over a curb, did a nice face plant in front of my house, broke a tooth and my nose, opened up my forehead pretty good too. They took that picture for me in the ER to carry around as a reminder. Of what? I'd just gotten out of my car after driving my 11-year-old daughter home to her mother. By then, I was up to 320 milligrams of OxyContin a day.
crushing and snorting first thing in the morning. Except for me, the mornings were the afternoon. I let him register that for a few moments before continuing. So, Patrick, you think what you did was stupid? I was driving my little girl around on 320 mg of hillbilly heroin. Now I shook my head. There's nothing you can do about the past, Patrick, except keep it there. He was staring directly at me in the mirror. I'm going to help you get through the legal stuff, I said. It's up to you to do the rest, and the rest is the hard part. But you already know that. He nodded. Anyway, I see a ray of light here, Patrick. Something Jerry Vincent didn't see.
What is it?
The victim's husband gave her that necklace. His name is Roger Vogler, and he's a big supporter of lots of elected people in the county. Yeah, he's big into politics. Mandolin told me that. They hold fundraisers and stuff at the house. Well, if the diamonds on that necklace are phony, he's not going to want that coming up in court, especially if his wife doesn't know. But how's he going to stop it? He's a contributor, Patrick. His contributions helped elect at least 4 members of the county board of supervisors. The county supervisors control the budget of the district attorney's office. The DA is prosecuting you. It's a food chain. If Dr. Vogler wants to send a message, believe me, it will be sent. Henson nodded. He was beginning to see the light. The motion I'm going to file requests that we be allowed to independently examine and appraise the evidence, to wit, the diamond necklace. You never know, that word appraise may stir things up. We'll just have to sit back and see what happens.
Do we go to court to file it?
No, I'm going to write this thing up right now and send it to the court in an email.
That's cool.
The beauty of the internet.
Thanks, Mr. Haller.
You're welcome, Patrick. Can I have my picture back now? He handed it over the seat, and I took a look at it. I had a marble under my lip, and my nose was pointing in the wrong direction. There was also a bloody friction abrasion on my forehead. The eyes were the toughest part to study. Dazed and lost, staring unsteadily at the camera. This was me at my lowest point. I put the photo back in my pocket for safekeeping. We drove in silence for the next 15 minutes while I finished the motion, went online, and sent it. It was definitely a shot across the prosecution's bow, and it felt good. The Lincoln lawyer was back on the beat. The Lone Ranger was riding again. I made sure I looked up from the computer when we hit the tunnel that marks the end of the freeway and dumps out onto the Pacific Coast Highway. I cracked the window open. I always loved the feeling I got when I'd swing out of the tunnel and see and smell the ocean. We followed the PCH as it took us north to Malibu. It was hard for me to go back to the computer when I had the blue Pacific right outside my office window. I finally gave up, lowered the window all the way, and just rode. Once we got past the mouth of Topanga Canyon, I started seeing packs of surfers on the swells. I checked Patrick and saw him taking glances out toward the water. It said in the file you did your rehab at Crossroads in Antigua, I said.
Yeah, the place Eric Clapton started.
Nice?
As far as those places go, I suppose.
True. Any waves there?
None to speak of.
I didn't get much of a chance to use a board anyway.
Did you do rehab?
Yeah, in Laurel Canyon.
That place all the stars go to?
It was close to home.
Yeah, well, I went the other way. I was as far from my friends and my home as possible. It worked.
You thinking about going back into surfing? He glanced out the window before answering. A dozen surfers in wetsuits were straddling their boards out there, waiting on the next set.
I don't think so. At least not on a professional level. My shoulder's shot.
I was about to ask what he needed his shoulder for when he continued his answer.
The paddling's one thing, but the key thing is getting up. I lost my move when I fucked up my shoulder. Excuse the language.
That's okay.
Besides, I'm taking things one day at a time. They taught you that in Laurel Canyon, didn't they?
They did, but surfing's a one day at a time, one wave at a time sort of thing, isn't it? He nodded, and I watched his eyes. They kept tripping to the mirror and looking back at me. What do you want to ask me, Patrick?
Yeah, I had a question. You know how Vincent kept my fish and put it on the wall?
Yeah?
Well, I was,
wondering if he kept any of my boards somewhere?
I opened his file again and looked through it until I found the liquidator's report. It listed 12 surfboards and the prices obtained for them.
You gave him 12 boards, right?
Yeah, all of them.
Well, he gave them to his liquidator.
What's that?
It's a guy he used when he took assets from clients, you know, jewelry, property, cars mostly, and would turn them into cash to be applied toward his fee. According to the report here, the liquidator sold all 12 of them, took 20%, and gave Vincent $4,800. Patrick nodded his head, but didn't say anything. I watched him for a few moments and then looked back at the liquidator's inventory sheet. I remembered that Patrick had said in that first phone call that the two longboards were the most valuable. On the inventory, there were two boards described as 10 feet long. Both were made by One World in Sarasota, Florida. One sold for $1,200 to a collector, and the other for $400 on eBay, the online auction site. The disparity between the two sales made me think the eBay sale was bogus. The liquidator had probably sold the board to himself cheap. He would then turn around and sell it at a profit he'd keep for himself. Everybody's got an angle, including me. I knew that if he hadn't resold the board yet, then I still had a shot at it.
What if I could get you one of the longboards back? I asked. That would be awesome. I just wish I'd kept one, you know?
No promises, but I'll see what I can do. I decided to pursue it later by putting my investigator on it. Cisco showing up and asking questions would probably make the liquidator more accommodating. Patrick and I didn't speak for the rest of the ride. In another 20 minutes, we pulled into the driveway of Walter Elliott's house. It was of Moorish design, with white stone and dark brown shutters. The center facade rose into a tower, silhouetted against the blue sky. A silver mid-level Mercedes was parked on the cobblestone pavers. We parked next to it.
You want me to wait here? Patrick asked.
Yeah, I don't think I'll take too long.
I know this house. It's all glass in the back. I tried to surf behind it a couple of times, but the rip's too strong.
Pop the trunk for me. I got out and went to the back to retrieve my digital camera. I turned it on to make sure I had some battery power and took a quick shot of the front of the house. The camera was working and I was good to go. I walked to the entrance and the front door opened before I could push the bell. Mrs. Albrecht stood there, looking as lovely as I'd seen her the day before. When Walter Elliott had told me he would have someone meet me at the house in Malibu, I hadn't expected it to be his executive assistant. Mrs. Albrecht, how are you today?
Very well. I just got here and thought maybe I'd missed you.
Nope, I just got here too.
Come in, please.
The house had a two-story entry area below the tower. I looked up and saw a wrought iron chandelier hanging in the atrium. There were cobwebs on it, and I wondered if they had formed because the house had gone unused since the murders, or because the chandelier was too high up and too hard to get to with a duster.
This way, Mrs. Albrecht said.
I followed her into the great room, which was larger than my entire home. It was a complete entertainment area, with a glass wall on the western exposure that brought the Pacific right into the house.
Beautiful, I said.
It is indeed. Do you want to see the bedroom?
Ignoring the question, I turned the camera on and took a few shots of the living room and its view.
Do you know who's been in here since the sheriff's department relinquished control of it? I asked.
Mrs. Albrecht thought for a moment before answering.
Very few people. I do not believe that Mr. Elliott has been out here. But, of course, Mr. Vincent came out once, and his investigator came out a couple of times, I believe. And the sheriff's department has come back twice since turning the property back over to Mr. Elliott. They had search warrants.
Copies of the search warrants were in the case file. Both times they were looking for only one thing, the murder weapon. The case against Elliott was all circumstantial, even with the gunshot residue on his hands. They needed the murder weapon to ice the case, but they didn't have it. The notes in the file said that divers had searched the waters behind the house for 2 days after the murders, but it also failed to come up with the gun.
What about cleaners? I asked. Did someone come in and clean the place up?
No, no one like that. We were told by Mr. Vincent to leave things as they were, in case he needed to use the place during the trial.
There was no mention in the case files of Vincent possibly using the house in any way during the trial. I wasn't sure what the thinking would have been there. My instinctive response upon seeing the place was that I wouldn't want a jury anywhere near it. The view and sheer opulence of the property would underline Elliot's wealth and serve to disconnect him from the jurors. They would understand that they weren't really a jury of his peers. They would know that he was from a completely different planet. "Where's the master suite?" I asked.
"It comprises the entire top floor."
"Then let's go up." As we went up a winding white staircase with an ocean blue banister, I asked Mrs. Albrecht what her first name was. I told her I felt uncomfortable being so formal with her, especially when her boss and I were on a first-name basis.
"My name is Nina. You can call me that if you want."
"Good. And you can call me Mickey." The stairs led to a door that opened into a bedroom suite the size of some courtrooms I had been in. It was so big, it had twin fireplaces on the north and south walls. There was a sitting area, a sleeping area, and his and her bathrooms. Nina Albrecht pushed a button near the door, and the curtains covering the west view silently began to split and reveal a wall of glass that looked out over the sea. The custom-made bed was double the size of a regular king. It had been stripped of the top mattress and all linens and pillows, and I assumed these had been taken for forensic analysis. In two locations in the room, 6-foot square segments of carpet had been cut out, again, I believed, for the collection and analysis of blood evidence. On the wall next to the door, there were blood spatter marks that had been circled and marked with letter codes by investigators. There were no other signs of the violence that had occurred in the room. I walked to the corner by the glass wall and looked back into the room. I raised the camera and took a few shots from different angles. Nina walked into the shot a couple times, but it didn't matter. The photos weren't for court. I would use them to refresh my memory of the place while I was working out the trial strategy. A murder scene is a map. If you know how to read it, you can sometimes find your way. The lay of the land, the repose of victims and death, the angle of views and light and blood. The spatial restrictions and geometric differentiations were all elements of the map. You can't always get all of that from a police photo. Sometimes you have to see it for yourself. This is why I'd come to the house in Malibu. For the map. For the geography of murder. When I understood it, I would be ready to go to trial. From the corner, I looked at the square cutout of white carpet near the bedroom door. This is where the male victim, Johann Rilts, had been shot down. My eyes traveled to the bed, where Mitzi Elliott had been shot, her naked body sprawled diagonally across it. The investigative summary in the file suggested that the naked couple had heard an intruder in the house. Rilts went to the bedroom door and opened it, only to be immediately surprised by the killer. Rilts was shot down in the doorway, and the killer stepped over his body and into the room. Mitzi Elliott jumped up from the bed and stood frozen by its side, clutching a pillow in front of her naked body. The state believed that the elements of the crime suggested that she knew her killer. She might have pleaded for her life, or might have known her death could not be stopped. She was shot twice through the pillow, from a distance estimated at 3 feet, and knocked back onto the bed. The pillow she had used as a shield fell to the floor. The killer then stepped forward to the bed and pressed the barrel of the gun against her forehead for the kill shot. That was the official version, anyway. Standing there in the corner of the room, I knew there were enough unfounded assumptions built into that that I would have no trouble slicing and dicing it at trial. I looked at the glass doors that led out to a deck overlooking the Pacific. There had been nothing in the files about whether the curtain and doors had been open at the time of the murders. I was not sure it meant anything one way or the other, but it was a detail I would have liked to know. I walked over to the glass doors and found them locked. I had a hard time figuring out how to open them. Nina finally came over and helped me, holding her finger down on a safety lever while turning the bolt with her other hand. The doors opened outward and brought in the sounds of the crashing surf. I immediately knew that if the doors had been open at the time of the murders, then the sound of the surf could have easily drowned out any noise an intruder might have made in the house. This would contradict the state's theory that Rilts was killed at the bedroom door because he had gone to the door after hearing an intruder. It would then raise a new question about what Riltz was doing naked at the door, but that didn't matter to the defense. I only needed to raise questions and point out discrepancies to plant the seed of doubt in a juror's mind. It took only one doubt in one juror's mind for me to be successful. It was the distort or destroy method of criminal defense. I stepped out onto the deck. I didn't know if it was high or low tide, but suspected it was somewhere in between. The water was close. The waves were coming in and washing right up to the piers on which the house was built. There were 6-foot swells, but no surfers out there. I remembered what Patrick had said about attempting to surf in the cove. I walked back inside, and as soon as I re-entered the bedroom, I realized my phone was ringing, but I'd been unable to hear it because of the ocean noise. I checked to see who it was, but it said private caller on the screen. I knew that most people in law enforcement blocked their ID. Nina, I have to take this. Do you mind going out to my car and asking my driver to come in?
No problem.
Thank you. I took the call. Hello.
It's me. I'm just checking to see when you're coming by.
Me was my first ex-wife, Maggie McPherson. Under the recently revamped custody agreement, I got to be with my daughter on Wednesday nights and every other weekend only. It was a long way from the shared custody we'd once had. But I'd blown that, along with the second chance I'd had with Maggie. Probably around 7:30. I have a meeting with a client this afternoon, and it might run a little late. There was silence, and I sensed I'd given the wrong answer. What, you've got a date? I asked. What time you want me there?
I'm supposed to leave at 7:30.
Then I'll be there before that. Who's the lucky guy?
That wouldn't be any of your business, but speaking of lucky, I heard you got Jerry Vincent's whole practice.
Nina Albrecht and Patrick Henson entered the bedroom. I saw Patrick looking at the missing square in the carpet. I covered the phone and asked them to go back downstairs and wait for me. I then went back to the phone conversation. My ex-wife was a deputy district attorney assigned to the Van Nuys courthouse. This put her in a position to hear things about me.
That's right, I said. I'm his replacement.
But I don't know how lucky that makes me.
You should get a good ride on the Elliott case.
I'm standing in the murder house right now. Nice view.
Well, good luck in getting him off. If anyone can, it's certainly you.
She said it with a prosecutor's sneer.
I guess I won't respond to that. I know how you would anyway. One other thing. You're not going to have company over tonight, are you?
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about 2 weeks ago. Haley said a woman was there. I believe her name was Lainey. She felt very awkward about it.
Don't worry, she won't be there tonight. She's just a friend, and she used the guest room. But for the record, I can have anybody I want over at my house at any time because it's my house, and you are free to do the same at your house.
And I'm also free to go to the judge and say you're exposing our daughter to people who are drug addicts.
I took a deep breath before responding as calmly as I could.
How would you know who I'm exposing Haley to?
Because your daughter isn't stupid, and her hearing is perfect. She told me a little bit of what was said, and it was quite easy to figure out that your friend is from rehab.
And so that's a crime, consorting with people from rehab?
It's not a crime, Michael. I just don't think it is best for Haley to be exposed to a parade of addicts when she stays with you.
Now it's a parade. I guess the one addict you're most concerned with is me.
Well, if the shoe fits. I almost lost it, but once again calmed myself by gulping down some of the fresh sea air. When I spoke, I was calm. I knew that showing anger would only hurt me in the long run when it came time to readdress the custody arrangement.
Maggie, this is our daughter we're talking about here. Don't hurt her by trying to hurt me. She needs her father, and I need my daughter.
And that's my point. You are doing well. Hooking up with an addict is not a good idea.
I was squeezing my phone so hard I thought it might break. I could feel the scarlet burn of embarrassment on my cheeks and neck.
I have to go. My words came out strangled by my own failures.
And so do I. I'll tell Haley you'll be there by 7:30.
She always did that, ended the call with inferences that I would disappoint my daughter if I was late or couldn't make a scheduled pickup. She hung up before I could respond. The living room downstairs was empty. But then I saw Patrick and Nina out on the lower deck.
I stepped out and over to the railing where Patrick stood staring at the waves. I tried to put the upset from the conversation with my ex-wife out of my head.
Patrick, you said you tried surfing here but the rip was too strong?
That's right.
Are you talking about a riptide?
Yeah, it's tough out here. The shape of the cove creates it. The energy of the waves coming in on the north side is redirected under the surface and sort of ricochets south. It follows the contour of the cove and carries it all the way down and then out. I got caught in that pipeline a couple of times, man. It took me all the way out past those rocks at the south end.
I studied the cove as he described what was happening beneath the surface. If he was right, and there was a riptide on the day of the murders, then the sheriff's divers had probably searched in the wrong place for the murder weapon. And now it was too late. If the killer had thrown the gun into the surf, it could have been carried in the underwater pipeline completely out of the cove and out to sea. I began to feel confident that the murder weapon would not be making a surprise appearance at trial. As far as my client was concerned, that was a good thing. I stared out at the waves and thought about how beneath the beautiful surface, a hidden power never stopped moving. The writers had taken the day off or moved their picket line to another protest location. At Archway Studios, we made it through the security checkpoint without any of the delay of the day before. It helped that Nina Albrecht was in the car in front of us and had smoothed the way. It was late, and the studio was emptying out for the day. Bo was able to get a parking spot right in front of Elliot's bungalow. Patrick was excited because he had never been inside of the gates of a movie studio. I told him he was free to look around, but to keep his phone handy, because I was unsure how long the meeting with my client would last, and I needed to stick to a schedule for picking up my daughter. As I followed Nina in, I asked her if there was a place for me to meet with Elliot other than his office. I said I had paperwork to spread out and that the table we had sat at the day before was too small. She said she would take me to the executive boardroom, and I could set up there while she went to get her boss and bring him to the meeting. I said that would be fine. But the truth was, I wasn't going to spread documents out. I just wanted to meet with Elliot in a neutral spot. If I was sitting across from him at his work table, he would have command of the meeting. That was made clear during our first encounter. Elliot was a forceful personality, but I needed to be the one in charge from here on out. It was a big room with 12 black leather chairs around the polished oval table. There was an overhead projector and a long box on the far wall containing the drop-down screen. The other walls were hung with framed posters of the movies that had been made on the lot. I assumed that these were the films that had made the studio money. I took a seat and pulled the case files out of my bag. 25 minutes later, I was looking through the state's discovery documents when the door opened and Elliot finally walked in. I didn't bother to get up or extend my hand. I tried to look annoyed as I pointed him to a chair across the table from me. Nina trailed him into the room to see what she could get us for refreshment. "Nothing, Nina," I said before Elliot could respond. "We're going to be fine and we need to get started. We'll let you know if we need anything." She seemed momentarily taken aback by the issuance of orders from someone other than Elliot. She looked to him for clarification and he simply nodded. She left, closing the double doors behind her. Elliot sat down in the chair I had pointed him to. I looked across the table at my client for a long moment before speaking. "I can't figure you out, Walter."
"What do you mean? What's to figure out?"
"Well, for starters, you spend a lot of time protesting your innocence. But I don't think you're taking this that seriously."
"You're wrong about that."
"Am I? You understand that if you lose this trial, you are going to prison. And there won't be any bail on a double murder conviction while you appeal. You get a bad verdict, and they'll cuff you in the courtroom and take you away."
Elliot leaned a few inches toward me before responding again.
"I understand exactly the position I am in. So don't dare tell me I'm not taking it seriously."
"Okay then, when we set a meeting, let's be on time for it. There's a lot of ground to cover and not a lot of time to cover it. I know you have a studio to run, but that is no longer the priority. For the next 2 weeks, you have one priority. This case."
Now he looked at me for a long moment before responding. It may have been the first time in his life he had been chided for being late and then told what to do. Finally, he nodded.
"Fair enough," he said.
I nodded back. Our positions were now understood.
We were in his boardroom and on his studio lot, but I was the alpha dog now. His future depended on me.
Good, I said. Now, the first thing I need to ask is whether we're speaking privately in here.
Of course we are.
Well, we weren't yesterday. It was pretty clear that Nina's got your office wired. That may be fine for your movie meetings, but it's not fine when we're discussing your case. I'm your lawyer, and no one should hear our discussion. No one. Nina has no privilege. She could be subpoenaed to testify against you. In fact, it won't surprise me if she ends up on the prosecution's witness list.
Elliot leaned back in his padded chair and raised his face toward the ceiling.
Nina, he said, mute the feed. If I need anything, I will call you on the line.
He looked at me and opened his hands. I nodded that I was satisfied.
Thank you, Walter. Now let's get to work.
I have a question first.
Sure.
Is this the meeting where I tell you I didn't do it, and then you tell me that it doesn't matter to you whether I did it or not?
I nodded. Whether you did it or not is irrelevant, Walter. It's what the state can prove beyond a...
No!
He slammed an open palm down on the table. It sounded like a shot. I was startled, but hoped I didn't show it.
I'm tired of that legal bullshit! That it doesn't matter whether I did it, only what can be proved. It does matter! Don't you see? It does matter! I need to be believed, God damn it! I need you to believe me! I don't care what the evidence is against me. I did not do this. Do you understand me? Do you believe me? If my own lawyer doesn't believe me or care, then I don't have a chance!
I was sure Nina was going to come charging in to see if everything was all right. I leaned back in my padded chair and waited for her, and to make sure Elliot was finished. As expected, one of the doors opened and Nina was about to step in, but Elliot dismissed her with a wave of his hand and a harsh command not to bother us. The door closed again, and he locked eyes with me. I held my hand up to stop him from speaking. It was my turn.
Walter, there are two things I have to concern myself with, I said calmly. Whether I understand the state's case and whether I can knock it down.
I tapped a finger on the discovery file as I spoke.
At the moment, I do understand the state's case. It's straightforward prosecution 101. The state believes that they have motive and opportunity in spades. Let's go with motive first. Your wife was having an affair, and that made you angry. Not only that, but the prenuptial agreement she signed 12 years before had vested, and the only way you could get rid of her without splitting everything up was to kill her. Next is opportunity. They have the time your car left through the gated archway that morning. They've made the run and timed it again and again and say you could have easily been at the Malibu house at the time of the killings. That is opportunity. And what the state is counting on is motive and opportunity being enough to sway the jury and win the day, while the actual evidence against you is quite thin and very circumstantial. So my job is to figure out a way of making the jury understand that there is a lot of smoke here, but no real fire. If I do that, then you walk away. I still want to know if you believe I am innocent.
I smiled and shook my head. Walter, I'm telling you, it doesn't matter.
It does to me. One way or the other, I need to know.
I relented and held my hands up in surrender. All right then. I'll tell you what I think, Walter. I've studied the file forward and backward. I've read everything in here, at least twice and most of it three times. I have now been out to the beach house where this unfortunate event happened and studied the geography of these murders. I have done all of that, and I can see the very real possibility that you are innocent of these charges.
Does that mean that I believe that you are an innocent man?
No, Walter, it doesn't. I'm sorry, but I've been doing this too long. And the reality is, I haven't seen too many innocent clients. So the best I can tell you is that I don't know. If that's not good enough for you, then I'm sure you will have no trouble finding a lawyer who will tell you exactly what you want to hear, whether he believes it or not. I rocked back in my chair while awaiting his response.
He clasped his hands together on the table in front of him while he chewed on my words, and then he finally nodded. "Then, I guess that is the best I can ask for," he said. I tried to let out my breath without his noticing. I still had the case, for the moment. "But you know what I do believe, Walter?"
"What do you believe?"
"That you're holding out on me."
"Holding out? What are you talking about?"
"There's something I don't know about this case, and you are holding back on it with me."
"I don't know what you are talking about."
"You're too confident, Walter. It's like you know you are going to walk."
"I am going to walk. I'm innocent."
"Being innocent is not enough. Innocent men sometimes get convicted, and deep down everybody knows it. That's why I've never met a truly innocent man who wasn't scared. Scared that the system won't work right, that it's built to find guilty people guilty and not innocent people innocent. That's what you're missing, Walter. You're not scared."
"I don't know what you're talking about. Why should I be scared?"
I stared across the table at him, trying to read him. I knew my instincts were right. There was something I didn't know, something that I had missed in the files, or that Vincent had carried in his head instead of his files. Whatever it was, Elliot wasn't sharing it with me yet. For now, that was okay. Sometimes you don't want to know what your client knows, because once the smoke comes out of the bottle, you can't put it back in.
"All right, Walter," I said. "To be continued. Meantime, let's go to work."
Without waiting for a reply, I opened the defense file and looked at the notes I had written on the inside flap. "I think we're set in terms of witnesses and strategy when it comes to the state's case. What I have not found in the file is a solid strategy for putting forth your defense."
"What do you mean?" Elliot asked. "Jerry told me we were ready."
"Maybe not, Walter. I know it's not something you want to see or hear, but I found this in the file." I slid a 2-page document across the polished table to him. He glanced at it, but didn't really look at it.
"What is it?"
"That is a motion for a continuance. Jerry drew it up, but hadn't filed it. But it seems clear that he wanted to delay the trial. The coding on the motion indicates he printed it out Monday, just a few hours before he was killed."
Elliot shook his head and shoved the document back across the table.
"No, we talked about it and he agreed with me to move forward on schedule."
"That was Monday?"
"Yes, Monday. The last time I talked to him."
I nodded. That covered one of the questions I had. Vincent kept billing records in each of his files, and I had noted in the Elliot file that he had billed an hour on the day of his murder.
"Was that a conference at his office or yours?"
"It was a phone call, Monday afternoon. He'd left a message earlier and I called him back. Nina can get you the exact time if you need it."
"He has it down here at 3. He talked to you about a delay?"
"That's right, but I told him no delay."
Vincent had billed an hour. I wondered how long he and Elliot had sparred over the delay.
"Why did he want a continuance?" I asked.
"He just wanted more time to prepare, maybe pad his bill. I told him we were ready, like I'm telling you. We are ready."
I sort of laughed and shook my head.
"The thing is, you're not the lawyer here, Walter. I am. And that's what I'm trying to tell you. I'm not seeing much here in terms of a defense strategy. I think that's why Jerry wanted to delay the trial. He didn't have a case."
"No, it's the prosecution that doesn't have the case."
I was growing tired of Elliot and his insistence on calling the legal shots.
"Let me explain how this works," I said wearily. "And forgive me if you know all of this, Walter. It's going to be a 2-part trial, okay? The prosecutor goes first and he lays out his case. We get a chance to attack it as he goes. Then we get our shot, and that's when we put up our evidence and alternate theories of the crime."
"Okay."
"And what I can tell from my study of the files is that Jerry Vincent was relying more on the prosecution's case than on a defense case. There are..."
"How so?"
"What I'm saying is that he's locked and loaded on the prosecution side. He has counter-witnesses and cross-examination plans ready for everything the prosecution is going to put forward. But I'm missing something on the defense side of the equation. We've got no alibi, no alternate suspects, no alternate theories, nothing. At least nothing in the file. And that's what I mean when I say we have no case. Did he ever discuss with you how he planned to roll out the defense?"
"No. We were going to have that conversation, but then he got killed.
He told me that he was working all of that out. He said he had the magic bullet, and the less I knew, the better. He was going to tell me when we got closer to trial, but he never did. He never got the chance. I knew the term. The magic bullet was your get-out-of-jail-and-go-home card. It was the witness or piece of evidence that you had in your back pocket that was going to either knock all the evidence down like dominoes or firmly and permanently fix reasonable doubt in the mind of every juror on the panel. If Vincent had a magic bullet, he hadn't noted it in the case file. And if he had a magic bullet, why was he talking about a delay on Monday? "You have no idea what this magic bullet was?" I asked Elliot. "Just what he told me, that he found something that was going to blow the state out of the water." "That doesn't make sense if on Monday he was talking about delaying the trial." Elliot shrugged. "I told you, he just wanted more time to be prepared. Probably more time to charge me more money. But I told him, when we make a movie, we pick a date, and that movie comes out on that date, no matter what. I told him we were going to trial without delay." I nodded my head at Elliot's no-delay mantra, but my mind was on Vincent's missing laptop. Was the magic bullet in there? Had he saved his plan on the computer and not put it into the hard file? Was the magic bullet the reason for his murder? Had his discovery been so sensitive or dangerous that someone had killed him for it? I decided to move on with Elliot while I had him in front of me. "Well, Walter, I don't have the magic bullet, but if Jerry could find it, then so can I. I will." I checked my watch and tried to give the outward appearance that I was not troubled by not knowing what was assuredly the key element in the case. "Okay, let's talk about an alternate theory." "Meaning what?" "Meaning that the state has its theory and we should have ours. The state's theory is that you were upset over your wife's infidelity and what it would cost you to divorce her. So you went out to Malibu and killed both your wife and her lover. You then got rid of the murder weapon in some way, either hid it or threw it into the ocean, and then called 911 to report that you had discovered the murders. That theory gives them all they need, motive and opportunity. But to back it up, they have the GSR and almost nothing else."
"GSR?"
"Gunshot residue. Their evidentiary case, what little there is, firmly rests on it."
"That test was a false positive," Elliot said forcefully. "I never shot any weapon, and Jerry told me he was bringing in the top expert in the country to knock it all down. A woman from John Jay in New York. She'll testify that the sheriff's lab procedures was sloppy and lax, prone to come up with a false positive."
I nodded. I liked the fervor of his denial. It could be useful if he testified. "Yes, Dr. Arslanian, we still have her coming in," I said. "But she's no magic bullet, Walter. The prosecution will counter with her own expert saying exactly the opposite, that the lab is well run and that all procedures were followed. At best, the GSR will be a wash. The prosecution will still be leaning heavily on motive and opportunity."
"What motive? I loved her, and I didn't even know about Riltz. Thought he was a faggot."
I held my hands up in a slow-it-down gesture. "Look, do yourself a favor, Walter, and don't call him that, in court or anywhere else. If it is appropriate to reference his sexual orientation, you say you thought he was gay, okay?"
"Okay."
"Now, the prosecution will simply say that you did know Johann Riltz was your wife's lover, and they'll trot out evidence and testimony that will indicate that a divorce forced by your wife's infidelity would cost you in excess of $100 million and possibly dilute your control of the studio. They'll plant all of that in the jury's minds, and you start having a pretty good motivation for murder.
And it's all bullshit.
And I'll be able to potshot the hell out of it at trial. A lot of their positives can be turned into negatives. It will be a dance, Walter. We'll trade punches. We'll try to distort and destroy, but ultimately, they'll land more punches than we can block, and that's why we're the underdog, and why it's always good for the defense to float an alternate theory. We give the jury a plausible explanation for why these two people were killed. We throw suspicion away from you and at somebody else.
Like the one-armed man in The Fugitive.
I shook my head. Not exactly. I remembered the movie and the television show before it. In both cases, there actually was a one-armed man. I was talking about a smokescreen, an alternate theory concocted by the defense because I wasn't buying into Elliot's "I am innocent" rap. At least not yet. There was a buzzing sound, and Elliot took a phone out of his pocket and looked at the screen.
Walter, we have work here, I said.
He didn't take the call and reluctantly put the phone away. I continued.
Okay, during the prosecution phase, we are going to use cross-examination to make one thing crystal clear to the jury. That is, that once that GSR test came back positive on you, then
false positive!
Whatever. The point is, once they had what they believed was a positive indication that you had very recently fired a weapon, all bets were off. A wide-open investigation became very tightly focused on one thing. You. It went from what they call a full-field investigation to a full investigation of you. So what happened is that they left a lot of stones unturned. For example, Rilts had only been in this country 4 years. Not a single investigator went to Germany to check on his background and whether he had any enemies back there who wanted him dead. That's just one thing. They didn't thoroughly background the guy in LA either. This was a man who was allowed entry into the homes and lives of some of the wealthiest women in this city. Excuse my bluntness, but was he banging other married clients or just your wife? Were there other important and powerful men he could have angered, or just you?
Elliot didn't respond to the crude questions. I had asked them that way on purpose, to see if it got a rise out of him, or any reaction that contradicted his statements of loving his wife. But he showed no reaction either way.
You see what I'm getting at, Walter? The focus, from almost the very start, was on you. When it's the defense's turn, we're going to put it on Rilts. And from that, we'll grow doubts like stalks in a cornfield.
Elliot nodded thoughtfully as he looked down at his reflection in the polished tabletop.
But this can't be the magic bullet Jerry told you about, and there are risks in going after Rilts.
Elliot raised his eyes to mine.
Because the prosecutor knows